This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, welcome to our final session in the Vaka Moana seminar series. I'm Jenny Newell. I work at the Centre for Historical Research here at the National Museum of Australia. And also want to thank Adam Blackshaw and Leanne Dempsey. Thank you, that's better. Of Public Programs, co-conveners of this program. In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge that we are on the land for which the Ngambri and Ngunnawal people have been custodians for many centuries. We acknowledge their living culture and give thanks for their contribution to and support of the museum's enterprises. This series has drawn on the themes of the Voyages of the Pacific Ancestors, Vaka Moana exhibition, which is next door, and which is still open until the 18th of October. The speakers within this series from universities and museums around Australia have taken us from the techniques of traditional voyaging to the history of Australian traders and travellers around the Pacific, to contemporary ways that museums are engaging with and presenting and documenting Pacific seafaring. One of the key points that this exhibition makes very clearly is the way Pacific Islanders have always and continue to lead lives intimately intertwined with the Pacific. One of the things I was particularly looking forward to in designing these seminars was the chance to have some personal stories that would give us, here in our landlocked location, insights into the deep and abiding ways that others have lived with the sea, how people living and travelling across the Pacific have relied upon the ocean for day-to-day survival, had it as the foundation of their cultural and spiritual life, and drawn upon it for their livelihoods. Today's speakers, Deveni Temu and Sioana Faupula from the Australian National University and Prue Ahrens from the University of Queensland, will provide us with three unique perspectives, from family stories to views from travellers and tourists. Their accounts will add life and spice to the more static displays next door. And Sioana has a particularly lively treat for us at the conclusion. We will be recording today's session, so at question time, following each speaker, please wait for the microphone and also say who you are. Thank you before asking your question. Now introduce our first speaker, Deveni Temu. Deveni was born and raised in a Papua New Guinean coastal village about 220 kilometres east of Port Moresby. After qualifying and working as a high school teacher, he became one of Papua New Guinea's first qualified librarians, with a postgraduate diploma from the University of Wales, Aberystwyth. He gained a master's degree from Monash University and went on to become a chief librarian at the Papua New Guinea University of Technology, then at the Secretariat of the Pacific Community in Noumea. He moved to Canberra in 1999 to manage the library at the School of Theology in Barton. He is currently the ANU Pacific Librarian based in the Menzies Library. Deveni is passionate about Papua New Guinea art and culture and is, with colleagues here at the museum and in Papua New Guinea, involved in the Living Art exhibition planned for 2013. He participates actively in promoting Papua New Guinea culture, welcome, through song and dance in Canberra. We're fortunate to have him here today to enlighten us about coastal life in Papua New Guinea. Please welcome Deveni Temu.
Thank you, Jenny. I'd like to begin by paying homage to my maternal uncles, Pokana Vekwala, Walokamu Tauvau, and my maternal aunt, Samoa Ila Vekwala. These three great seafarers were the ones who introduced me to the sea, and they were the ones who told me a great saying in the part of Papua New Guinea that I come from. Because when I first took my trip with them in a canoe, I was so terrified that they thought, you know, I wasn't going to survive. And so they told me this quote, and it's always said to children or people that they take on board. And this is roughly what it says in English. A true seaman is one whose loincloth is permanently damp. And that stuck with me for a long time. And those three great maternal uncles and aunt were the ones who introduced me to the sea, and it's their story as much as mine. But before I go on to the personal stories, I would like to show you where exactly where I am from. Now you can see on that map there, it's the Cape Rodney area, and that's the name given to the area that I come from, where these villages are, which I will cover in my talk. And the names of these two villages are called Kapari and Viriolo. Kapari is a Aroma-speaking village, and Viriolo is Hula-speaking. And these two villages are unusual in their locations. About 100 years ago, that's where these two villages are. About 100 years ago, Viriolo village, a family, what I was going to say was a clan, but it's a small family that had a dispute with the rest of the village people, and then they decided to move west. And I'll just bring up the next slide to show you where the location of these other villages are, where they moved. So you can see on that map, this is where they moved from Alukuni, which is a Hula-speaking village, and shifted right down to the Aroma area. This is about 100 years ago. And as far as I'm aware from oral sources, my ancestors told me, they came on a canoe, this particular family, and settled on a beach close to where Kapari is currently located. And they were there for about 4 years. And during those 4 years, the Kapari who lived inland saw these people, and they had these wonderful skills in their canoes, and so they were able to fish. And so when the Kapari saw this, they decided that they would try and befriend them. And then that's exactly what happened. So today, we have these two villages existing side by side. And as you can see on that map there, that coastal area, right down to Port Moresby, in the inset there of the map of Papua New Guinea, the coastal area, the location of these villages, is about 220 kilometers east of Port Moresby. It's almost midway between Port Moresby and the very eastern tip, Milne Bay. They have been there, as I said, nearly 100 years now, and have developed this wonderful system. And so when I was growing up, the Viriolo, who are fishermen and provided fish, the Kapari, who are the agriculturalists, developed this bartering system of exchange of fish and vegetables. And that trade has continued. But like everything else in Papua New Guinea these days, it has now become, obsolete, in that, money has taken over this trade. So fish is exchanged for food, for money, no longer food. But, there are within individual households exchanges. But one of the most important things with these special villages is that it explains this whole ethos that we have in our coastal villages, that any stranger that comes past your village or your place should be made welcome by offering them food or fish. And this is what happened with the Kapari and the Viriolo people. And this tradition has continued. So, for example, if there is a Mailu canoe, which is further east, traveling to Port Moresby, and with rough weather they stop by along our coast and in our villages, our people are always ready to help if they are in need of water or food or things like that. So it's a wonderful tradition that has been maintained, apart from the vegetable and fish bartering system, which has now been taken over by money. Now, as I said, to the Kapari and Viriolo, the sea is as important a part of the environment as the land. The reefs, sandbanks are all sources of food, and the beaches provide major walking tracks. They also provide the place to locate their villages. Now, on that map there, situated at the eastern end of the chain of Hula-speaking villages. And as I've already said, approximately 200 kilometres from Port Moresby, Kapari and Viriolo are unusual in their proximity to each other. Kapari stands on a small sandy peninsula formed by the Auro River. Today, some of the houses are placed well back on the firm ground behind the village, forming the northern edge. The rest end in traditional manner, close to the sea, on the bank, which shelves into the water. At high tide, the sea laps beneath the floors of the nearest row. Viriolo is only 20 metres away across a strip of water where the river joins the Coral Sea. Its houses are built above a sandbank whose boundaries constantly shift, which even at high tide affords dry ground in the centre of the village. This is a shot of Viriolo at high tide. As you can see, there's also this was taken in 2003, and as you can see, these houses are now made of a modern European style materials, and this is a result of this the skills they had in fishing. Some of you probably will know that the Hula people who used to come and sell fish at Koki in Port Moresby. Some of those people were from Viriolo, and when Viriolo people discovered that they could make money and build permanent houses, they got on their canoes and travelled to Port Moresby and set up in Port Moresby. And some of them came for a few months. Sometimes they stayed for 2 or 3 years making money. When they made enough money, they bought their corrugated iron roofing, fibro, and went back and built their houses. And it's interesting, in 1971, when I took a high school teacher home, there were several traditional houses still there in the village. And he said, oh, those things, the traditional houses look much more romantic and, you know, more suitable for the climate than these. But then, you see, my uncles told him that, you know, these are permanent constructions. We don't want to reconstruct every 5-10 years. So, you know, they were smart in that, you know, when they saw the opportunity to make money, they got on their canoes, came down to Port Moresby, made the money and went and built these houses. Yeah. The next shot is this is Viriolo in the 50s. That's the same shot taken of the newer one you saw, the 2003, and this is the old traditional houses. Thank you. A big, big change. We can talk about this too. These are Viriolo people. You saw that, you know, at high tide, the houses were, you know, the sea went right up. Now, this is after church. They're returning home to their villages, and this house with the fibro sheet, yeah, they're walking past. That's Kapari house. Now, the Kapari house has shifted out to Viriolo because they now prefer living close to the sea near the beach because it's much cleaner. The sea comes and washes away all the rubbish, and it's also cool and airy. Now, I paid homage to my uncle and aunt, and there are two gentlemen there, my uncle Pokana and Uncle Walo. This is a canoe that he built. Now, in 1985, I was at Monash, and I went home on field work. And because I had saved quite a bit of money, my mum said that, you know, your uncle had built a canoe, so he doesn't really use a sail, so can you get him an outboard motor? And it's their tradition that you know, the sister's children help out the uncle, and this is what I did. I bought an outboard motor for them. And in this particular day when they went out, it's a custom that when the canoe and the outboard motor or the new sail is put to sea, there has to be certain protocols followed. And one of these is that the house must not be swept, because the fishermen leave about 6 in the morning, and food must not be cooked for the whole day till their return. But the whole village knows that this outboard motor and this canoe are going on their first trip. So at the end of the day, when the fishermen return, everybody will come with cooked food as the canoe comes in. And when the canoe pulls in onto the beach, the fish is taken out and distributed and given to every individual person who comes with their food to celebrate. This one was taken by Bill Standish. This was in 2003. And I selected this because it shows you the banana boat and the traditional double-hulled little river canoes. And this is on the other side of the river. This is, if you remember the map, the Mauwai is the river that separates the village. And some of the Viriolo houses are built right into the sea and also literally over the Coral Sea. And this river feeds right out into the Coral Sea. This river is also infested with crocodiles, but, you know, these village people are very smart. They live side by side with them, and I'm nearly 60 now. And in that lifetime, there has never been a single crocodile attack on any human being. Now, this is an interesting one because I wanted to show you this because it shows you how the traditional double-hulled canoes have been taken over by these banana boats. You will see this all along now, which is in many ways very sad because in 1991, when I went from Leh, and my wife is Irish, so we both went to visit my mother, and there was not a single banana boat in the village. That's 1991, and we visited again in 2003, and this is what we get. They've gradually been replaced. That's another shot. Yep. Now, this is again taken in 2003. At least there are still individuals who are able to make these canoes. This is a new canoe being constructed by these two men. And the next one should show the finished product. Oops, sorry. This is it. And the canoe is finished. You can see it's under this house. And these two cousins are cooking the fish that their father has caught from the river. Now, this particular shot is a... you will recall that where the shot of my uncle's going on the fishing expedition. That was... it's the same kind of canoe, but this one has been built up with the timber surroundings. And this was my uncle's nephew's canoe. This canoe was used in the 60s when I finished grade 6 from the village and I was selected to go to boarding school at Sogeri, which is up from Port Moresby. My cousin who owned this boat took about 12 of us plus 4 crew members. And it's a distance of 220 kilometers traveling from Kapari Viriolo to Port Moresby along the coastline. And, you know, it was quite a load because we had food, we had all of us, about 20 of us packed into a boat like this. And one of my responsibilities, because I was a family member, was to keep bailing any water that came into the canoe. And, you know, this trip during the time when we were using the sails would take about 5-7 days. But with outboard motors, if the weather was good, it was 2-3 days. And so you can imagine we just kept traveling out in the sea, quite far away from the coast. So you are constantly sitting there, standing there in the canoe, bailing. And it was interesting with some of the students that came with us, because they were from the hill tribes, had never been into the sea before. They found the, you know, travel on the sea quite bad, in that, of course, they became seasick. But, you know, they were just so terrified, sitting right in the center of the canoe, huddled together. And here was us, bailing, trying to keep the boat afloat so that we reach Port Moresby. And there's always a saying in the Viriolo people, that never take the mountain people with you because they will not help if the canoe capsizes. Yeah. Now, this particular one is a shot because you can see the name up there, Karolua. Karolua was our ancestral canoe, ocean-going canoe, my father built in the 50s. And because he was orphaned at a very young age, he didn't have any family to help him to build his house. So he built his great big canoe. And this canoe was provided by the person who named me, Deveni, and he was a chief of a village from the mountain tribes. And of course, in the mountains, they have the great big logs and trees to make this canoe. So he provided the canoes for my father and built his canoe. And Karolua, Karo is language, Lua, Rua, in some of the, it's two. So it's bilingual. And it's because when one of the elders of the village was walking past while my uncles and family were building the canoe, he heard one of us speak hula and then switch to aroma. And so he said, oh, these children speak two languages, you know, Karolua. And so that's why my father called our canoe Karolua. But this particular sail, again, I provided for my brother. This is my brother's elder brother's canoe. It went took part in a race in 2003. Yeah. And this is just a shot of a family setting out on their river canoe, double-hulled river canoe. You can see there's quite a lot of them. And they're just setting out to the canoes. And when they come back, there's going to be lots of vegetables and things to put on the canoes. And so the canoes go right down, but they really manage how to get home without, you know, getting water and capsizing. But they really know how to maneuver. Yeah, I just finished very quickly. Okay. Yeah. And these are shots of some more shots of the 50s canoe races in the area that we come from. These are outrigger canoe races. Yeah, more shots of them. And I thought I should put this in very quickly. These are some of the village women. It again demonstrates the traditional and the new. These women are wearing a rice bag, you know, because they've made them. And I just wanted to illustrate the point about, you know, their preference for opting for something permanent. The traditional grass skirts, you know, wear out very quickly. So this is a modern a way of, you know, making use of somebody's rubbish, and it's a wonderful dress for them. And this is a very old shot of the village, Kapari village, which is the agricultural village. This is their traditional houses. You can't see those anymore. The last that I saw was in 1972. They're all gone. You can't see them now. And with this image, I will finish off now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you for such a lovely talk, Deveni. I have a question about your crocodiles. What was the relationship between the people and the crocodiles? So there was the arrangement that the crocodiles wouldn't eat the people. I mean, how did you work that one out?
I think, again, it's another saying. You know, they say you have to respect the sea and what's in it, and the sea will respect you. And so I suppose a lot of people go by that saying within the village. And also, you know, they know what time to go out and wash in the sea. I mean, literally, we do live side by side with the crocodiles because the houses really are built into the sandbanks. And, you know, when I was little, sometimes the crocodiles would come up under the houses of my uncles. And, you know, you knew them, you could see them. And you would always avoid them. But of course they would go and attack the pigs and the dogs that were wandering around the village. But as I said, I have never heard stories of people being taken. So, yeah, so it's they coexist quite happily.
Selata Ufa Etsri. What is the main source of income for this village when those houses were built in contemporary?
Yeah. So there's two villages, Kapari, they are the agriculturalists, and they do produce a lot of, root crops, banana, sugarcane, watermelons, pineapples, pawpaws, all those things. And they do have a local market within the area that they are in. And so there's about five or six villages that come to do a weekend market. But they also travel to Port Moresby. Now the road is through from, the Magi Highway. Some of you probably have heard of that, that connects the village. And of course, like everything else in Papua New Guinea, it's quite tough because the road is not that well maintained. But the interesting thing is that the Viriolo people don't market their fish, by sailing down. They use the outboard motor. They use the motor vehicles to travel down to Port Moresby. So they still sell their fish, and they're still very affluent. Because the fish is in high demand by almost every village along that coast. So they do pretty well, fish and agricultural products. But there's also commercial rubber plantations that were introduced in the 60s. Some families opted to take this over, and it's mostly the agriculturalists who have taken them on, and some have stayed on and working with the rubber plantations. The Viriolo people, as far as I know, three of them took them up in the 60s, but they just couldn't cope with, they missed the sea so much, they gave it up and came back to the village.
Time for one more question. Yes. Margaret Jolly, down the front, thank you.
Thanks very much, Davini. Margaret Jolly from the ANU. I was just wondering if you could tell us the reasons why people build houses over the sea, and also if there's any fear about threat from climate change and sort of sea levels rising.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a big, big problem for the Viriolo people, as you saw in one of those shots, the sea, because the populations have increased, so they're building out to the almost out to the outer reefs. And at, what king tides, as far as I can tell, last year, some of them came right up and washed, on the floors, and they had to shift everything on, put them up on beds and things. But they're now beginning to negotiate with the Kapari people. These are Viriolo people. They've given them land where they want to rebuild, but it's still along the coast. And I was back there in July. And when I was a child, there was a big tree that used to stand there, which was a landmark for this area that has been given for Viriolo people to build their new village, has been taken away. And coconuts have been taken away, so they say that it's still not a safe place to rebuild, so they're still building over the sea. I suppose for the Viriolo, it's this... it's in your psyche. It's in my psyche so much, that the sea, I mean, that even here when I meet Hula speaking, Montauk, there's only three of us here. And if we are traveling and we go to some place and I want to ask for a lift back, and I ask, whose canoe did you come in? And, it never occurred to me till somebody overheard me and asked, why are you referring to your car as canoe? But that's probably it. And for me personally, here in Canberra, I have this yearning and longing every time to go out to the sea. I suppose it's the connection. So, it's a difficult thing for Viriolo people whether they will shift into the mainland.
Thanks so much, Davini. Please join me in thanking Davini Turner. I was very pleased to have been able to entice Dr. Prue Ahrens down from Brisbane to join us here today to add her perspectives on Pacific travels through an exciting range of visual and ephemeral sources. I'm also glad that Canberra has put on a bit of warmth for her, which is a relief. Yes, it is.
Prue is a lecturer in art history at the University of Queensland. Her publications and curated exhibitions interrogate case studies of colonial modernity in the South Pacific. The most recent example of this is the book she's just finished co-editing, titled Coast to Coast, Case Histories in Modern Pacific Crossings. And I can vouch for her being an excellent editor, as she's very kindly let me be one of the contributors. Prue is a fellow of the Yale University Centre for Studies in British Art and Universitas 21. In 2009, she was awarded the John Haskell Campbell Fellowship to investigate Pacific Maritime Archives at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, Los Angeles. These research findings will be published in her forthcoming volume and also inform her paper today, Coast to Coast, Visual Histories of Modern Pacific Crossings from the Kemble Collection, Huntington Library. Please welcome Prue Ahrens.
Thank you, Jenny. And thank you, Devani, for a lovely talk. You're a hard act to follow. I thought about how I might best contribute to today's panel. The history, modern histories of Pacific maritime crossings have been the focus of some excellent scholarship just in recent years. Dr. Francis Steele, who's now at the University of Wollongong, has published a very detailed and complex history of the Union Steamship Company and the Trans-Pacific Mail Lines operating from the 1880s to 1910. Moreover, Dr. Jenny Newell has published histories of the collecting practices of trans-Pacific voyages, and specifically Jenny looks at the souvenir collectings on the Dauntless cruise of the 1920s and the exchanges between naval officers and Pacific communities. So as Jenny mentioned, in the coming months, I'm very pleased to be co-editing a volume that will feature her work and Francis Steele's work in a collection titled Coast to Coast, Case Histories of Modern Pacific Crossings. So, rather than repeat or summarise those histories that have been well documented, I thought what I might do in this short session is to introduce you to a collection over at the Huntington Library, which has recently become available to researchers of Pacific history, and that's the Kemble Collection of Maritime Ephemera. This is a very large and a very significant collection of archival material. Mainly, the material comes from the 19th and 20th century, and it, as I mentioned, it is printed ephemera, so that is to say printed media. We'll go through some details. But the collection as a whole really offers a fantastic insight into the ways in which links were forged across the Pacific in the modern period, mainly through commercial vessels. So there is very nice ephemera, both from crossings from the United States, particularly to the coast of Australia, but also networks within the Pacific Islands, and demonstrating how vessels and human labour and capital really created a network across the Pacific, transporting goods and people. So in January and February of this year, I was very, very grateful to be in residence at the Huntington Library, which is in San Marino in California, just outside of Los Angeles. The Kemble Collection was bequeathed to the library by John Haskell Kemble, who was a professor at Pomona College. And he spent his lifetime collecting maritime-related materials, which were primarily, but not exclusively, focused on the Pacific. Mainly, Kemble collected or purchased the materials from travel agencies and from other collectors, and he also collected ephemeral material from his own travels. And so the Kemble collection contains over 925... material from 925 maritime companies, shipping companies. And it includes shipping histories, travel brochures, schedules and passenger lists. In total, there are over 24,000 items in the Kemble Collection. And throughout his lifetime, he donated books and paintings to the Huntington Library, and upon his death, the ephemera collection was donated to the Huntington by his family. So the curators and the archivists at the Huntington Library, who are led by Mario Inaudi, have been processing this massive collection, really, since 1999, and it has become available to researchers just in recent years, in the past 2 years. And Mario advises that there is still work to be done on the collection, but a database that contains a company and folder list is available for researchers. So this is a very typical entry from the Kemble catalogue. The catalogue isn't available online. It's only available in hard copy from the curator. What I want to point out here, firstly, obviously, is the way in which the collection is catalogued under company name, the shipping company name. So in this case, we see the Australian Oriental Line, and the way in which it's cross-referenced, which is crucial because I very quickly learned that shipping companies changed frequently in terms of their administrations, have very complex administrative histories in the late 19th and 20th century. So the cross-referencing is really quite crucial. I'd like to also point out the diverse material that's contained in this ephemera collection. So, for example, this folder, as it says, contains brochures, schedules, menus and other items, including a wine list and stationery. Folder 1 contains the brochures, which have rate and schedule information, deck plans for the company's 2 ships and images of those ships. There is also a standalone schedule from 1933 and a wine list from 1960. The wine list includes a letter from the AO line to a Mr. Crane, who is seeking copies of the company's wine lists and menus. Majority of items and the menus found in folders 2 and 3, menus from the 2 ships, cover the end of the company's operations, although there are 2 menus from 1932 for the Taiping. The menus have some interesting covers, but are standard for late 1950s. So the holdings are diverse. They're really quite eclectic. For example, there is one folder which contains a face washer from an early oceanic cruise ship. But importantly, the assortment of items are organised around the specific maritime company that they relate to, and in many cases, the specific ship and vessel from which they came. So my background is art history, and my concern was really with the visual material. So in a collection of 24,000 items, I was firstly looking for maritime companies that had a trans-Pacific service. Either they were connected to a trans-Pacific service or had connections with Australia and the west coast of North America. So there are some obvious companies, the Occidental and Oriental Steamship Company, the Canadian Australasian Line, and the Oceanic Steamship. There are also not-so-obvious companies, for example, some of the Japanese shipping companies which had ties to both the west coast of the United States and to Australia. So in order to include within my investigation a broader sampling of maritime companies, I also widened my search to include companies that carried passengers to a certain point and then connected to another company which completed the crossing between United States and Australia. So that would include the Los Angeles Steamship Company, which was LA to Hawaii, and the Matson Line, which was San Francisco to Hawaii and then later to Australia. So really, my interest in this material was to investigate how a modernist rhetoric comes through early 20th century commercial imagery in this visual ephemera, which were produced by these passenger ships. Wouldn't really call them cruise ships at this stage. They were referred to as passenger ships. This investigation is really feeding into a larger project that is taking up my time at the moment, where I'm really wanting to look at painting and film documentary and ephemera that picture Pacific Islands through the Euro-American lens, in terms of its modernity as opposed to its primitivism and exoticism. And what I found was interesting within this visual ephemera was the picturing of these unlikely bedfellows, exoticism with an associated primitivism, and modernity with an associated claims to luxury. So it's an unlikely pairing of the modern and the exotic, and it does come through quite a lot of the passenger ship ephemera. as these passenger ships attempt to find their position or their niche in a very competitive Euro-American tourist market. And this modernist vision of trans-Pacific travel really isn't limited to, the South Seas, so the China Mail Company, for example, like the others were operating further south, really sold their voyage on the twin promise of modernity and its associated luxury and the exoticism of the Orient. But that's simply my approach to this Kemble collection. The ephemera could be investigated in multidisciplinary ways, and certainly not solely for information on the operations of the early passenger ships, but most definitely we can investigate this collection for richer cultural histories. So, for example, constructions of the East and West, and stereotypical imagery of their inhabitants. Constructions of, for example, Australia and Australianness. This one's really quite curious. Australia is being pictured here for its ski resorts. within the material, you could pick up on this prevalence of the use of the flag within the early 20th century advertising, the use of the map, and the connotations of imperialism that come with this kind of imagery. Or, for example, the evocation of classical myths surrounding ancient voyage and discoveries to being reinterpreted for modern commercial passenger ship travel. So clearly, for the researcher of visual histories, at the very least, there's really a wealth of information within the Kemble collection that could be interpreted through multiple perspectives. Simply what I've tried to introduce you to here is the potential of this archive for further scholarship, and perhaps a contribution that printed ephemera can make to our understandings of modern Pacific voyaging, modern crossings of the Pacific with this commercial basis. So really the archive offers endless opportunities for the historian or the writer or indeed the exhibition curator. That's all I wanted to share today.
Thank you, Prue. You're
and
welcome. We have some questions. Perhaps I could ask... Oh, yes, sorry. Okay, Dennis, thank you.
Back there.
Microphone's coming.
I'm just curious as to why you think he did it. Why did he collect so many things?
That is a very good question, because at the time they were rubbish. what he collected, boarding cards, menus, tremendous amount of foresight that this ephemera would become historically important. Certainly the rest of the passengers threw them out. Why he collected them, as a historian himself, perhaps he figured that one day these things would become important and could give us some insight into attitudes towards voyaging across the Pacific. That's all I can suggest. Bit of a bowerbird.
Is there any sense that he went on a voyage himself at some point? Started off his interest? Or?
Yes, he did travel himself. But all the same, 24,000 items.
That's true.
My name's Jennifer Rowland.
Yes.
Could I ask you or Jenny to expand on the notion of ephemera? We've had a little bit touching on that just a moment ago. Ephemera is usually termed or related to something that's not very important or has only a short-lived importance. But nevertheless, museums and art galleries and other institutions collect it, and we are discovering that it portrays a certain amount of social history. So is ephemera something that's not much of interest, but yet it is?
If I may, I'd like to disagree with the word important. I think ephemera does refer to important things. I think ephemera usually refers to not necessarily work that will last. Some ephemeral production, in my understanding, usually refers to dance, performance that can't necessarily be kept. So that's my understanding of ephemera. That's printed ephemera. Again, it's I would suggest that really the term refers to something that wasn't really made to last for a long time. What would you say, Jenny? Mm.
Yes, exactly, and that these things can still give us access to the ways that people were experiencing the world and wanting to present their particular enterprises to the world. And so, useful in all sorts of ways, I think, for the historian and others. So.
Mm. I think so.
Does that answer your question?
Does it answer your question? Almost.
That's right.
Yes.
Thank you. In the front,
I think so.
Thank you.
Hello, Issa from the museum. I was just interested that you said that they were known as passenger ships rather than cruise ships.
Yes.
But essentially they did fulfil the role of a cruise ship, didn't they?
Not really.
Okay.
Cruise ships, as we understand it, where the whole idea is, as Cunard would create this catchphrase, where getting there is half the fun. That really didn't come in until the 1950s and 1960s. These ships were first and foremost transporting goods. They were trade ships, but they took passengers on as well. So they really were passenger ships, and this idea of cruising came through the way we understand it in the 1950s and 60s. But then in the 1930s, I suppose the idea of cruising came along, but it was very much an upper-class activity. And in steerage, the people who would go onto these ships in the 1930s in steerage were usually immigrants, and so they were there to get from A to B. But that idea of, as I said, Cunard's phrase of getting there is half the fun was 1950s and 60s, really.
And could I just ask, did you get any sense from the archive of the sorts of experiences that the passengers were having when they did stop off in Hawaii or Samoa, and the sorts of maybe the encounters they were having with the locals? Were they sort of bringing things back on board?
Yeah.
Would give you some insight into that sort of relationship?
Sadly not. Surprisingly, within this archive, there really isn't the souvenir from the places in which they would stop over. There is more the souvenir from the ship itself. So it's very much an archive that's about maritime history, as opposed to necessarily contact with the various ports on the way. I was surprised by that. So really it is a contribution to maritime history.
Okay, thank you. And last question there from Margaret Jolly. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Margaret Jolly from the ANU. Thanks very much, Prue. I was really interested in what you were saying about modernity and how you're suggesting that modernity actually embraces the Pacific. I mean, one of the kind of interesting things, I think, in what you've shown us is very often you get this juxtaposition, like this one here, of the very sort of solid, almost kind of invasive, phallic sort of steamship, together with some sort of sort of feminised imagery. I mean, here it's like the angelic classical or whatever, you know, carrying on the wings, but there was that other one of the Australian-New Zealand line which had, you know, a slightly kind of modernised variant of a Maori woman, I think it was. So, I mean, how far do you think the modernity being captured in these images is the modernity of the West Coast of America, emergent Australia and New Zealand, and how far the modernity of the peoples of the Pacific themselves?
I think it's a great question. It's almost entirely modernity as Europe and America understand it. This is 1928. In the late 19th century, France certainly was trying to position its Pacific colonies as in terms of their modernity, and this sort of had a government push behind it, economic push behind it, trying to phrase, for example, Tahiti as an island of cotton and coffee, as a place for export, a place for investment, and a place for immigration, and immigration in terms of assimilation too with that culture. But it's very much a one-sided tale. These pictures really play out Americans speaking to Americans. It is a commercial basis, and really, in another sense, these pamphlets are an interesting study of the early developments of marketing and advertising and trying to find a hook for the paying customer. So I don't think really there's any necessarily relationship between what's pictured in these brochures, these advertisements, and the reality of life in the islands. And I don't think that was really their concern. I see you're nodding there. Would you agree? Yeah, I do think it was Americans speaking to Americans. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Please join me. Thank you. Thank you. Siouana Fapula is a celebrity, both here and on the airways, as a storyteller and news presenter for SBS Radio, and in Tonga, where she's frequently called back to take part in major events. Siouana has many interests in the Pacific Islands community including Pacific women and cultural heritage of Tonga. She's been a teacher, starting in Sydney, then at the Queen Salote College in Nuku'alofa. She married the Reverend Haloti Faupula in 1966, and since then has been involved in training and community work through the theological colleges, schools and churches of Tonga and Australia. She and her husband were missionaries in Yirrkala throughout the 1970s. Siouana is now a lay preacher for the Uniting Church here in Canberra. She's also president of the Canberra Tongan community. She's been a translator and assistant archivist at the Pacific Manuscripts Bureau at the ANU since 2001. I'm sure you're all looking forward, as much as I am, to her account of Tin Can Island volcano eruptions. Please welcome Siouana.
Good morning, everyone. Now I'm going to be controlled by somebody else. I had to have a little drink to cool me down. As you can see, my hands are shaking already. I would like to pay respect to the traditional owner of this land, academic scholars, organizers of this historic program, my fellow speakers, Prue and Deveni, ladies and gentlemen. The story of Tin Can Mail and volcano eruptions took place in the most remote island in the Kingdom of Tonga, called Niuafoʻou. You can see a glimpse of it as you sail on the fringe of Tonga, of Tongan waters from Samoa to Fiji. It is a volcano on an underwater ridge, 190 kilometers west of the line of all the other volcanoes of Tonga. The island is a steep side calderas. The rim is over 120 meters high, rising to the peak of Mokoto, which is 250. The coastline is rocky and steep with no reef, and the few beaches are stony with some black sand. Back in 1882, William Travers, a plantation manager, found himself marooned on this tiny donut-shaped island. All he could see a couple of miles out to sea is a passenger ship steaming past, but none ever called, because the island had no harbour. He was the only white man on the island, and he resented being unable to communicate with the outside world. So when the need to contact his company in Australia became desperate, he came up with an ingenious plan. He wrote to the Tongan postal authorities, asking them to seal his mail in a ship's biscuit tin and arrange for the captain of one of the Union steamship company vessels to throw it overboard. As they passed, the island on their way between Samoa and Fiji. These ships traded regularly between the islands of the Pacific. If the captain would give a hoot on the ship's siren, he would send a swimmer out to collect the tin. He wrapped his letter carefully in greaseproof paper and tied it to a short stick. He asked the strongest swimmer on the island to swim out to the next ship and hand his letters to the captain. In this way, Tingen Mail was born. However, the strong currents meant that a swimmer often struggled for up to 6 hours to retrieve a mail tin dropped from a ship only a mile offshore. In 1921, Charles Ramsay came to Niuafoʻou as a plantation manager. He too needed to communicate with the outside world and took over the task of swimming the mail. He was the only white man to do so. He went out 112 times in all weathers. When a ship came past at night, it would blow its siren and the swimmers would go out as a group, one carrying a lamp. Back on shore, they would build a bonfire to guide the swimmers home. There were times when Ramsay did come close to death. In one incident, one of the postmen was attacked by a shark and died. This news upset the Queen and ordered that in future, mail was to be collected by outrigger canoe. This was much more difficult because the boats had to be thrown from the cliff top. The crew had to jump into the water and climb aboard. In 1928, George Gwenzel arrived on the island and quickly realized that philatelic interest could be generated by this unique method of delivering the mail. And so with a child's printing set, he produced a rubber stamp which read Tingen Mail and stamped it to all the outgoing letters. The total eclipse of the sun in 1930 was best viewed from Niuafoʻou and had a major impact on what was now known as Tingen Island. Paul de Venderfer, the director of education in Suva, accompanied the American expedition as chief photographer. He liked the idea of caches, and the scientists were quick to produce one of their own to commemorate the occasion. Paul also persuaded Gwenzel to develop his idea further and have rubber stamps made in New Zealand. Gwenzel arranged with ship's captain that if passengers mailed their letters in a tin together with sixpence to cover stamps and cost, he would apply his caches before posting them on. Captains soon applied rubber stamps of their own, telling the story of Tingen Island and the ship which carried the letter. The history of these caches has now become a study in itself. Naturally, the passengers loved to watch the natives collecting the mail, and soon most of the cruise liners made a point of calling at Tingen Island. People wrote from many parts of the world, enclosing their sixpence in a self-addressed envelope. The islanders benefited a lot from the interest that this generated, because instead of a vessel visiting once a year to collect the copra harvest, they now had visits from cruise ships as often as twice a week. This not only the mail, newspapers and magazines, but fresh meats and vegetables, as well as news of the outside world. The Tingen Mail is only one part of the story of Niuafoʻou. The heart of it lies in the nature of the island itself and its active volcanic history. Being a volcano, Niuafoʻou was subject to constant traumas, but in 1946, there was a huge eruption and half the island was buried under lava. Miraculously, no lives were lost, but within 20 minutes, Gwenzel's house with his entire collection of Tingen Mail were among the casualties. Tingen Mail continued for over 100 years, and in 1983, an airfield was built, and sadly, it all came to an end. At 7 o'clock on the night of the 9th of September 1946, from the distance came a faint rumble as of thunder. Ears lifted to the west from where the sound had come. Throughout the night, the people of Niuafoʻou shivered, fearful, for they were, some of them, unfamiliar to these earthquakes and hurricanes. The dawn came, offering little hope and comfort. Over the island's smoldering ruin hung a film of steam, pierced here and there by spirals of blue smoke from lava fires, which burned in the undergrowth. The island itself was a scarred and battered shell, and the principal town of Angaha had all but vanished. Here is a quote from one of the men who experienced the eruption. While I was talking to Antonio, there was a fantastically loud explosion, and the whole country rumbled, terrifying, and I heard the people, men and women, burst out shouting, it's erupting at Futu. Shortly after the explosion and the rumbling of the craters, a glow appeared in the sky, but one couldn't tell exactly where it was erupting from. At that moment, I thought to myself, I would never again see such a terrifying thing for the rest of my life. The whole country was lit like daytime. When I looked up at the moon, it seemed as if it were floating in a sea of blood. At the moment I looked down to the center of Angaha, it looked to me as though it had been completely covered with flames and smoke, and I thought to myself that Angaha had been completely burned out. Not one building was still visible. The waves of lava were breaking in all directions, and nothing but the glow and burning rocks could be seen. The continuous rising of the lava was to all appearance like a sea of gold. And again, the craters threw up rocks into the sky, which destroyed everything they landed on, turning it into a great desert of rocks. How could it ever fade from memory in the hearts and minds of the Niuafo'o people? And anyone who were in Niuafo'o on that night and who saw with their own eyes the astounding events on the 9th day of September 1946. It is impossible to describe the terror of this tragedy experienced by the Queen's people. Following the eruption in 1946, the Tonga government decided to evacuate the entire population to the islands of Tongatapu. The Tonga police magistrate, Salesi Manoahave, who was my father, was sent to Niuafo'o on the 22nd October 1946 with orders from the Privy Council, backed by the evacuation ordinance, to evacuate the entire population. The members of the Niuafo'o Evacuation Committee went with him. He asked Fusitu'a, the noble of Niuafo'o, to call a meeting so he could inform the people of the evacuation order. Fusitu'a refused. He did not want to leave Niuafo'o and saw no reason why people living in his village should leave. He did not want to go because it meant that he will lose his home, village, his income and status. He also claimed that the inland villages of Esia, Kolofo'o, Sapa'ata, Fata'ulua, Mata'aho, Tongamama'o and Petani were in no danger and would never be destroyed by eruption. Against this background, Manoahavea called a general meeting in Kolofo'o village on the 29th of October and made the most memorable speech ever given on the island. He first disowned all personal connection with the evacuation order and then claimed that he believed an expected evacuation would take place, but that someone would be crucified for it. When he finished his speech, the evacuation was in the hands of the Evacuation Committee on Niuafo'o and the Privy Council in Nuku'alofa. His public orders were to pull down houses and make sure that they are marked for identification, to make copra for ready cash to assist the migrants in their new homes, to plait sennit from coconut fiber and to weave new mats, and generally prepare for evacuation. The Hifafua removed some people and some of their belongings late in October, when the Mātua, these are the two boats, that they used for evacuating the people. When the Matu arrived on December to take the last group, it was emphasized that only personal effects and goods were to accompany the evacuees on the Matua. This was a mistake. When this last group arrived at Nuku'alofa, they had nothing. Most were taken to a hastily prepared campsite at Waikele. The Niuafu'au Evacuation Committee was unprepared for people without basic possessions. There was little shelter and food was in scant supply. Taken from an island where food was plentiful and where their family possessions remained, the evacuees were dependent upon the goodwill of the people of Tongatapu for everything necessary to keep them alive. The Queen had personal responsibility for the people. She was not only a descendant of a former Fotofili of Niuafu'au, but she owned the estate of Mata'aha on the island. During the preceding 10 years, pressure had grown from the Niuafu'au people for permission to return to their ancestral home, to their ruined houses and gardens, the graveyards of their forebears, and above all, to resume the struggle for survival against the forces of nature. To permit them to return was an agonizing decision for Queen Salote and her ministers to take. In September 1958, the first party of 200 was allowed to go back to their devastated island, an occasion of such sentimental significance that it's not easy for non-Polynesians to fully comprehend. The island was a history of 9 eruptions in the past century. On each occasion, villages, paths, houses, and gardens had been destroyed. Yet, they are there today, fearful but happy, no longer landless exiles, but back with their ancestors. This has given me interest because, as you can hear, my father had been ordered to go and evacuate these people from Niua. And with that interest, there was a song composed by him, and for that to save me having to answer questions, I have asked my family to help and support me by doing a Tongan dance to end up this session in the Pacific ways. And so I hope you will bear with us and hope that this story had given you a little bit of our kingdom of Tonga. I have to say something about the Malau birds. The people have left the human beings and only these living beings were left because they like the hot sand and that's where they love to lay their eggs. So they couldn't go to Tonga, they had to live in Niua. I think the girls are here. I'll tell you when they come in. I think they're just as nervous as I am. Didn't take long, huh? That's all right. And I want to acknowledge the director of the Manuscripts Bureau here, who has come specially to hear the talk. And I hope I get some points for it. And I have some friends and family from the Uniting Church in Civic. Thank you for coming. Thank you. They went for walkabout. I thought I would be the one to do that because I was with the Aborigines. To go walk about. Where did they go? See, they love me because they don't want to ask any questions.
Scorpion.
Thank you.
Malo apito. I'm sure that saves me with having to answer your questions. And I would like to say thank you to her. And as you can see, it's only maybe a few days that they have to learn. It's a little bit difficult. The song is difficult to express. And I would like to say thank you to the teacher who has done a very good job here for us today and make her be able to do it. Marlo, thank you.
Marlo, thank you so much, everyone, for coming today. And thank you very much to Siwana and her wonderful friends and family for helping us to celebrate all that we've been discussing here and all that we've been exploring together. So thank you very much, and thank you for joining us and for being here. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.